Good evening and welcome to Tuesday Topics. Let me begin by thanking Rachel and Larry in Orlando for their usual wonderful job of recording, and let me continue by thanking our editor Dave Williams in the UK. And third and last, let me thank George Byes of Talking Communities for making the software available for ACB to use and for this program to function on. Tonight on Tuesday Topics, we're going to discuss an interesting topic. We think maybe there'll be some humor, perhaps there'll be a lot of don'ts, and we hope there'll be some do's as well. Last week, one of the things that came up was how interesting it was to live on one's own as a person who's blind. And we thought that this week it might be interesting to explore what some of the do's and don'ts are of living independently as a blind person. And essentially what we kind of focused on was the question, what should you do and what should you know if you're thinking about moving out on your own as a blind person? But before we get really serious, let me ask folks who are present if they could perhaps talk about something not so nice that happened to them when they first moved out on their own. Maybe what was the biggest shock that they had, or perhaps what was the funniest thing that happened and that surprised them once they got living on their own.
Hi, Dave McElroy here, and I'll jump in with my story. Dave McElroy, Visalia, California. I started living on my own, I'm trying to remember whether it was in my sophomore or junior year of college. I think it was my junior year. I moved out from the dorm and into an apartment. When we were in the college dorm, you know, we paid our bills, our phone bills, whenever they paid. And, you know, I always just paid whenever I could get somebody to write the check for me and all that. So it worked out all right. Well, I found out very roughly, I went into my apartment, my first apartment. I was really proud, and the phone, I got my own phone and everything, and the phone company was, they said, your parents have such a sterling record, you know, you don't need to pay a deposit. Oh, that was fine, that was fun. So, anyway, off I was. Well, suffice it to say that I went off on a trip somewhere. I can't even remember where. I think I ran up to Northern California for something, and I came back. 3, 4, 5 days later, came back to my apartment in Riverside and picked up the phone, and all I heard was this buzz. There's no dial tone, just this buzz. And I thought, oh, what's wrong with the phone? So the next morning, I went to the payphone down in the complex, and I called, and they said, well, you didn't pay your bill, Mr. McElroy. And I had the money, I went and paid the bill, but then I had to pay a $25 deposit, too. So little lessons like that you learn, the phone company doesn't care about whether you're going on a trip to Northern California or not. If you live in Southern California, they want their money, and so that was a little lesson learned.
Hey, everybody, my name is Matt Roberts from Florida, and my worst situation of living on my own was back in 1997. I had a roommate at the time, and we had some problems, and I decided that he needed to go for a while. I won't go into any details as to what the problems were, but I decided that if he wasn't going to cooperate, he wasn't going to basically go with what our situation was, he didn't need to live there. So I threw him out, and a few days later, my landlady started bugging me. She's like, oh, well, you know, her attitude was I couldn't live on my own because I was blind. Well, I tried everything I could do to prove to her I could and all this. It didn't work. And the worst part was one day she up and called my parents because I made a real big mistake of calling her house from their house, so she had their phone number. And she took it upon herself to use it without consulting me or anything. And when I confronted her about it, she said, well, I was concerned about you living on your own and you being there by yourself. I said, I can't remember if I used your name or not, but I said, I have been by myself on weekends and during the week since I was 16 years old. I certainly know how to handle stuff, and I certainly know how to ask questions if I need it. And it just went downhill from there. Her son didn't believe I could live on my own. He caused so much problems I had to bar him from the property. I basically told him, I said, look, you're not coming on this property anymore. So it was a real bad situation, all because I was blind. But once my roommate came back, she basically left us alone. But if he wasn't there, she literally gave me nothing but problems, and I eventually decided that it wasn't worth living there anymore.
Goodness. Hi, this is Debbie Hazelton from Florida also. And Actually, some of what I'm thinking of, I wasn't totally on my own. I was still at home, but I was staunchly independent. At least, you know, trying to be. And, you know, whatever my mother said not to do when she wasn't there, I would do when she wasn't there, like the laundry. Well, you know, the colors being sorted and all that, I just threw it all in. And I did a load of laundry with powdered milk. She kept the powdered milk up over the washer and dryer because it wouldn't fit in the cupboard. It was a very large box, and I poured a cup in the washer and did a load and didn't know what it was or what I was doing. I also cooked. I was trying to make onion soup, the kind that is in the package that's Lipton in the box. And I poured in and didn't know what it was that was swelling up and making such a mess. So I boiled instant potato pancake mix. And I almost made shake and bake yellow squash. Probably the most frustrating thing of living on my own, aside things like paperwork and trying to figure out what's what in the refrigerator or something, is having an animal do something in the house, whether it's a guide dog or a cat, and either finding it or not finding it and trying to sort that out.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that, because I had an experience somewhat similar to yours, but it was the exact opposite, if that makes sense. Let me explain. I went to visit some friends in another part of Florida. I was no longer living. I was in college, but I'd gone back to visit some other friends who were living in DeLand, or I had been in school. Well, she gave me the run of the house, which I loved, because I know what it's like when people don't want you. I had an aunt who would sit up, who would fall asleep in front of the television because she didn't want me to be alone. But when I had my brother, you know, stay up with me, we went to visit her. Well, this time this lady said, okay, good night. You know, she had three young teenagers, boys. She said, okay. So I decided, I watched whatever television was on, and I decided to go to bed. And I decided I was going to load the dishwasher. I've been doing that for years. And I started, you know, I was looking around, and I was looking at the way things were laid out. So I knew how she liked it loaded. Everybody likes their washer loaded differently. I got that done. And then I went to look for the dishwashing detergent. And all I could find was what appeared to be a box of Tide. So I said, oh dear, she must have it some other place. I looked under the sink. I looked, you know, wherever I could think to look. So I said, next morning, I said, gee, Jean, she says, I would have had the dishwasher started, but I didn't know where the dishwasher washer detergent would be. And she said, oh, I don't use, I said, I saw something, but I didn't think that was it. And she said, oh, I'm very allergic. I can't use dishwasher detergent. I use Tide.
Hello, this is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. When I was at the rehab center in Kalamazoo, I used to, for washing my clothes, I thought it was easier for me to use something called Salvo at the time. It was like in cake form. You just put it in with your clothes and then just turn it on and then you wash your clothes. And that kind of, it's probably like this Tide kick today. And I looked at some dishwasher soap, and that kind of does the same thing. There's like in little tablets or pellets or whatever they call them. But when I'm by myself here, I do pretty well cooking with using TV dinners or doing leftovers in the microwave. I've never was taught how to use that at the center, but they probably didn't use them that much. I didn't get one until about 30 years ago. And then I started using the microwave for, I make instant cereal with it sometimes, and I can heat up leftovers with it pretty well. And like if they're in styrofoam or something like that, I do pretty well with that. So I can do things pretty easily with the microwave, and the microwave popcorn tastes pretty good.
One of the things that came up in that discussion was a question that I thought might come up, We heard from Matt that he ran across a landlady who didn't think that he could live on his own effectively because he was a blind person. Have other people had similar experiences, and how did you deal with them? Did you essentially deal with them in the same way as Matt did, by being resistant and then eventually giving up and simply moving on to someplace else, or did you find another approach?
Pam Drake from Visalia, California. I did have a couple of issues. One was very minor, very minor. I was late going to work one day, and when I first moved in, the superintendent of my building, I and my mother came, long story, but at that time my mother kept showing up at my place unannounced. In fact, the time for me to leave Florida drew near when she informed me that she was having friends at my apartment for lunch and my apartment better be clean. And I said, now wait a minute. You know, I was working by that time. And a few other issues like that, and I was gone. But anyway, this one particular day, she said to me on the phone, oh, I heard you were late for work today. And I said, oh, yeah? She said, yeah. Al told me. So I'm sure he didn't mean anything by it, but I told him, I said, Al, if you would appreciate, you know, not telling everything I do to my mother. But my apartment in Jersey, my first apartment in Jersey City, New Jersey, I was looking for a place, and I went to this particular building. I was told by, I don't know, the city housing developed somebody. I forget who I called, and they told me to contact this particular real estate company. The real estate agent, or the rental agent, said fine. So I went to see the apartment, and they had a studio. They told me that the one bedroom was no longer available. So I went back and cried myself practically to sleep in my hotel room, an old hotel I was staying in at the time. And a few days later, the real estate agent call, or the manager calls back and says, hey, do you want this apartment, or do you? And I said, well, they told me it wasn't available. And he says, I'll call you right back. Turned out that what had happened was that that apartment building, very nice, very clean, very well maintained, was located right next door to a very transient hotel where they put the people who were burned out of their buildings, the people who were evicted, the people that they were concerned about me having to have anything to do with. In fact, when I first attempted to go there for that particular place, the cab drivers were, you know what that place is? Well, I didn't. I soon found out. That's another story. But at any rate, the real estate man called me back and he said, be gentle with these people. They don't know anything. They've never seen a blind person. So I wrote out the check, or she wrote out the check, and I signed the check. And I said, I understand you've got some concerns. And the dam just burst. Oh, yes, well, I've been watching a soap opera, and she's been having such a terrible time. She just lost her sight. And the world was just coming to an end. So I said, okay, let's just talk about this. First of all, if she just, you know, said, okay, I'm blind now, and I'm going to start over, it wouldn't be much of a soap opera. I guess not. And then I invited her over and showed her some of my equipment. Long story short, she became, you know, she and I became, I wouldn't say friends, but sometimes we sat together and chatted, and her daughter was threatened by one of the unsavory neighbors. And she actually called me one night to ask me if I had heard the altercation in front of the elevator. And I said, yes, I did. I heard what was said. I heard the threat. And yes, if you need me to testify, I will. And when my parents were visiting, she and her husband practically with tears in their eyes said, we were just dumb. We didn't know. And they were just really kind of sad how they were turned around, but how their attitude was so, they were scared to death to have me there not because I couldn't do it, but because somebody might hurt me.
One of the things that came up for me in what Pam talked about is the degree to which we constantly have to almost show off to the folks with whom we interact. And I'm reminded of a story that was really awful. I guess it sort of is. I moved into the dorm at the University College of the West Indies in Trinidad. And I'd already been in university for 3 years, and I was this seasoned veteran, and I knew all about university and so on. Everything was pretty much okay, except that everybody wanted to come and see the blind guy, because, of course, I was the first blind person to attend university in the Caribbean. And after a while, it really got old, and I got to the place where somebody came in and said, "Oh, what's that?" And they picked up a slate and stylus and handed it to me and said, "What's this?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, I'm so glad you asked me. That's my shaving mirror, see? What you do is you hold it up against your face, and then you can feel the hair coming through the holes so you can shave them." So I guess occasionally, sometimes we can be mean back as well.
One time somebody asked me, is your name Trudy? Debbie Hazelton again, by the way. They said, "Is your name Trudy?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Oh, you look just like my friend Trudy, and she has a dog that looks just like your dog." And I walked away muttering under my breath, "Oh, yes, we're all from the same litter."
This is Matt from Florida. The thing I hate, we're talking about people recognizing us, is you're in a gathering of people, and there's another blind person in the room, and they'll say, "Oh, well, you need to meet so-and-so." And I'm like, and my response is, "Why? What's so special about this person?" "Oh, well, they're blind. You'll have something in common." I said, "Not necessarily."
Picture this, though. A black person comes into a room that's mostly white folks, and there's another black person in the room. And the hostess walks up to the black person and says, "Oh, well, you've got to meet John, because he's black, and you really need to meet him, because you black people ought to stick together." Do we suppose that would happen?
Oh, I know that sometimes when people have said to me, "Do you know my third cousin who lives in Africa that's also blind?" I mean, basically, you know, assuming that we all know each other. I've said, "Do all fat people know each other?"
This is Matt, by the way, Florida. I'm the only blind person in my apartment complex, which is actually good because they kind of used me as a guinea pig. And I think one of the things that I really had to struggle with, and I've got a handle on it now, but it took me a while, was getting the apartment complex to notify me about things in a way that I could use, instead of just throwing printed material on my door. And I kept asking them to do it, kept asking them to call me, "Oh, we'll do it." And they'd forget it. Well, there were a couple of incidents where they learned the hard way, "We better call Matt or else, because if they don't call me before they're supposed to come in that apartment, they ain't coming in there." And that's almost happened, because I don't believe that people should be able to do that. Because talking about meeting people don't stay in my apartment complex very long, and the ones that do stay there are not people I want to hang around with for very reasons. So I wonder how many other people have had that problem where the apartment complex fails to notify you about, like, maintenance needs to come in there, or the air conditioning is going to get looked at, or they're going to change the fire extinguishers, or things like that.
Many folks who are blind do not have a lot of income, and therefore many of us who are blind, when we move out on our own, end up perhaps moving into apartment complexes that certainly wouldn't be on Boardwalk and Park Place on the Monopoly board. And I wonder if A, people feel that that's the case, and B, assuming that it is, does that actually have an impact on the way that we have to operate.
This is Rachel in Orlando, and I don't expect that on the income that I had when I left my parents' house. I was actually still in college, and I know that there was no way I would have been able to afford a real, probably desirable place to live, at least for rent. So I was very, extremely fortunate that I have a real estate broker for a sister. And we ended up, I actually never rented, come to think about it. I went right from my parents' house to a small one-bedroom condo, and my parents helped me out with a little bit of money to put down as a down payment. And so all my payments right when I got out of my parents' house were on a mortgage payment. And I really felt safer there because I knew that most of the people there were homeowners and that they were not going to be, it wasn't going to have as much turnover in that complex as maybe an apartment complex would have. And I know that my situation is not something that most people are able to do, but it certainly in my case was, I very much appreciated being able to go right into a homeowner situation where I felt a little better about where I was living and the people that were living around me.
This is Larry in Orlando, and I've moved through several different apartments. First one was in St. Augustine, and that one only stayed in a few months because then I got accepted to DeVry Institute of Technology up in Atlanta, Georgia. So I moved up there and moved into student housing. DeVry, instead of having a dorm, they had several different subleasing agreements with several apartment complexes around, and the one I got was called Oak Tree Apartments, and they had, you know, they were kind of the low-income apartments, I guess. I mean, the apartments seem okay, but the neighborhoods were a bit rough, and I remember going through there several times, you know, at night, and you'd hear strange things in the woods and all that sort of stuff. And there were some people who looked out for me. The one night, a security guard was doing something out there. He was patrolling or something like that, and my guide dog AJ actually growled at him, and he stopped within 10 feet of me, and he would not come any closer. I calmed AJ, and I just told him, I said, just move on, and we'll, you know, move on towards the apartment, because I was out. I went up to the store to get something, and it was probably about 1 o'clock in the morning, which normally people in the rougher neighborhoods don't want to venture out at that time, but I wanted to get something to drink, so I headed up there and got it. And I finally left that apartment complex when one night, I guess it was about 4 in the morning, I heard a gunshot a couple blocks from me. I mean, it was loud. I knew what it was. There's no mistaking a gunshot once you hear it. And somebody had gotten murdered. So I was like, that's it. And then a couple of roommates and I chipped in and ended up getting an apartment of our own there.
Paul, this is William Benjamin in Tallahassee. And this brings up the dilemma that I have, that those folks that have the education or the upbringing, they know how to tap resources, but those that don't know how to negotiate and search out the things in life that really would make their life more comfortable, those are the ones that fall through the crack. How do we find those people and lend a helping hand?
I absolutely think you're right. But there are some corollaries to what you're saying. Many of the people who would fall into that category, at least the first time they end up moving out on their own, are typically clients of an agency serving blind folks. And one of the things that I think we need to do is to say to those agencies that before you encourage someone to move out onto his or her own, you need to provide them not only with some training, but also with some techniques and some tips. I'd also like to think this radio program helps. I think that Rachel brought up an interesting point, and it kind of goes right along with what William was talking about in Tallahassee, because what Rachel was saying is that she moved directly from where she was into a property that she owned. The truth is that particularly now, with incentives for low-income folks to buy houses, it's a good deal more possible for you to become a homeowner than many people believe that it is. And it actually may turn out to be considerably cheaper in the long run for you to do that if you can manage it. But again, I think we're often not told how all this works. Many of us, when we move out on our own, would probably qualify for Section 8 housing or would qualify for other services provided by Housing and Urban Development. But again, we never know that those services are available or that we might qualify for them. Well, we've established that people often had folks on the outside who didn't exactly accept the idea that they could live comfortably on their own. And I guess my question, are there other things that you can or should do about folks who make it difficult for people who are blind? And there are an awful lot of them.
I don't have time for people like that. If they're going to be that difficult, it usually isn't worth my time or effort to deal with them. Now, I'm not talking about friends. I'm talking about people. For example, when we were my now ex and I, when we were looking for our first apartment, we were trundling around on a bicycle built for two, and she saw I was blind and didn't want to rent to us, obviously, so it gave us an outlandish rent. I don't have time for people like that. I need to go on and find somebody that will rent to us, and that's what we did. It doesn't, generally speaking, there's not enough payoff for me in that kind of effort. Now, I would equate that differently to a person like when you move into a place, and like Pam's the situation where the lady. There wasn't an open hostility there, and I mean, my neighbors have taken. We've lived in this place for 6 years now, and I think my neighbors finally got used to the fact that this blind couple lives next door to them or across the street. I don't know what else I could have done. I just lived my life, and I was certainly always friendly and still am to everybody in around us. I don't know that you can do more. Maybe I'm not enough of a salesman. I don't know, but I don't believe in I don't believe in waving the cane, going out and saying, "Hey, look at what we can do." I just do it, and hopefully people will respond to that.
Yeah, this is Larry in Orlando. I guess the only way I could see that is that I would agree with Dave. A lot is going on in most of our lives where, we don't have time to deal with people like that. You just say, "Hey, if you don't want my business, I can take it elsewhere." Now, if there is a place that really fits your needs and it really works well, then it's a matter, and you really want to fight this tooth and nail, I mean, things can be done. It'd be a long process. You can get legal teams involved and all that sort of stuff, but, a lot of times it's just not worth the time and money that would be involved in that. I mean, you just have to look hard. I mean, because there are people who will, accept us and who we are. When I bought my first house up in Traverse City, Michigan, I had a pretty cool neighbor. He let me, live my life as I saw fit, and he was nice enough where sometimes he'd make some smoked salmon and bring it over and all that sort of stuff, and he'd ask if there was anything I need, but other than that, it was pretty good, and he even offered to help out with some of the snow blowing sometimes, but there was a lot of times that Rachel just reminded me another story here. I did a lot of my own snow blowing as well. I mean, you probably don't know too many blind people that are, brave enough to get behind a snow blower and operate this thing. But lo and behold, I did it because, Northern Michigan got quite a bit of snow every winter. And one day I was coming around the garage, going along, and, I'd completed everything fine, but later on, my neighbor approached me, and it turns out that I'd forgotten to turn the spout on the snowblower to aim the snow a different direction. Once I made the turn, I ended up sending a whole load of snow into his pickup, which was kind of... He laughed about it. He was good humored about it. He said, well, it's okay. It was slick that day, so I just happened to have extra weight for extra traction there. So
I was at a place for training one time at a they called Rehabilitation Industries here in town. I was being trained for some typing that I was interested in doing because I was working on dictaphone and I was going to be a general transcriptionist, as I said. But I, before I realized that that people put their canes down beside the chair. I mean, I had it standing up one time and somebody was walking through and then they knocked my cane or knocked my cup of coffee over and it burned my leg. And I didn't know really how to deal with that so much at the time. So I tried to put stuff on it, but I think I ended up with a secondary burn and I had to go to emergency on that. But I don't know that. I think, though, that there's some interesting stories here. Paul, I don't know if this would be an answer to your question, but I think if people choose to make the choice to live on their own, I think that the confidence is the most important thing. If they're confident in it, then people will know how well they're able to do it by how confident they feel about living on their own and being able to make a go of things like that, and how well they do in a crisis, I suppose, if there's a crisis or emergency, or how they ask for help if they need help.
And this is Larry. That's one of the most important things. If anyone is going to go out on their own, I mean, learning how to cook, clean, maintain the home, all that's very important, but I don't think anything is any more important than learning how to do first aid on either yourself or somebody else, because you don't know what could come up. I think first aid is a very important thing, you know, to handle an injury until you can get help.
I know when I lived in that place I mentioned earlier, this is Matt, by the way, I did everything I could to convince the landlady that I was independent. In fact, most of the house cleaning that was done, I did it myself because my roommate was out quite a bit, so I did a lot of the house cleaning. If I saw something needed to be done, I did it. I paid the bills. I did all that stuff. All he basically had to do was whatever he wanted to do because I handled all the administrative stuff in the house. No matter what I did, I even gave her a book about blindness, talking about how if blindness comes and everything. Whatever I did just didn't work. I just decided that it wasn't worth my time and effort to convince her that I could live on my own. I had to call that. I was on Section 8 at the time. I had to call the housing authority twice to get her to do stuff. So it just got to the point where I said, if this is the way I got to live, it isn't worth it. And I mean, she was calling me at 7 o'clock in the morning, which I felt was unreasonable. What I would say to people that are, so that's why I left, because I did everything I could think to do and it didn't work and I just didn't want to deal with it anymore. But what I would say is do a lot of research on wherever it is you want to go to. Make sure there's public transportation. There was not where I lived at that time. There was no public transportation. You had to have a car. So I think the important thing is to know what transportation options are available to you. If there are any stores nearby, how close are they? Is the place you're living at off a major highway or on a quiet street? Is it downtown? Is it suburbs? Where is it? And be up front with the people you're renting from. Be up front with the rental office or whatever it is and tell them, hey, I'm blind. You know, this is my situation. And, you know, you may have to educate people on that you can do things, and you may have to teach them, because maybe they've never dealt with it. You may have to teach them that you're able to do stuff. And if there's things you can't do for whatever reason, you do need to have local contacts to help you. Now, that's hard to find because that's been a real struggle. I have one friend in Orlando. If I need it, I can call on him, and he'll pretty much help me out because he knows I don't do it very often. But his work schedule is such that I can't rely on him all the time, so I have to get him when I can. But that's important. If you have folks you can depend on when you do need help with something, that's important. But also try to do as much as you can on your own if you can, and try to be creative if you have to find ways to do stuff.
This is Doug Lawler up in Paradise, Newfoundland, Canada. I'd like to sort of interject with a question. I don't know if this has ever been brought up on a Tuesday Topics before. This is my first time actually tuning into this. Has anyone ever rented an apartment or bought a house and had to deal with any type of inaccessible appliances, such as the main thing that comes to mind is stoves, all of these new stoves that are out on the market now? We bought an oven a couple of years ago, and I just can't use the thing at all.
That's a good excuse for not cooking, Doug, and welcome. We're glad to have you with us. I think you do bring up a good point. One of the things that people need to consider is how they are going to deal with the appliances and the places where they move in. A lot of us in the States have the option of, or had the option, I'm not sure it's as widely available now as it was, say, 10 years ago, but had the option of calling a person who was called a rehab teacher, who would actually come and do some marking on appliances, But an awful lot of people end up getting into apartments without really having a clear idea of how to use appliances and just have to kind of guess at it. The good news for most of us who are moving out on our own is that because we are moving into an apartment that's relatively inexpensive, the appliances are also relatively old, which means that even now most of them are pretty accessible. There are a lot of companies who make ovens, by the way, Doug, who actually have Braille templates or templates that are specifically designed to make them usable by folks who are visually impaired. And you might at least give the company's 800 number a call. We've heard a number of things that are do's, and let's try to put some of them in some context for other people and then go around and ask people to give some others that we haven't talked about so far. One, find a place that has a landlord who is at least prepared to recognize you as potentially human. Two, try to find a place that's on the bus route. Three, try to find a place that's within walking distance of stores and restaurants. And perhaps it might be interesting to do kind of one last round with asking people to add to that list. What are some of the other things that folks who are thinking about moving out on their own need to be sure to do?
Develop a network. Develop a network of people that you can call if you need to. You may never need them, but they're there. People who, whether they be friends, acquaintances, just kind of people who, in case you ever really get in a jam, that you've got to have somebody now. Now, I have to admit that has never happened to me, or word of Pam, I don't think, really. I don't think either one of us. But it's just a network of people that just in the event that something comes up that you just can't handle.
Well, I'm going to answer Paul's question. This is Matt, by the way, from Florida. But as blind people, it's very hard to meet people and develop that network that Dave is talking about, although that is a good suggestion. My question is, how do you do that? Other things I would suggest, like Doug's was talking about appliances, I know when my parents bought their house, they had a glass top stove, which I couldn't use it because I couldn't feel where the burners were. Well, because my mom hated it, she replaced it with a conventional stove that had real burners on it. So you need to be sure that if you get an apartment, that you know what kind of appliances they have, whether they're gas, electric, whatever. Some other things I would find out is make sure you know what fees you're paying, along with you can have a place. My apartment, I have a security deposit now, so I had to pay a redecoration fee plus an application. Make sure you know what your lease says. If the complex won't read it to you, have somebody read it to you so you know exactly what it says, because for a few years I didn't do that. They'd say to me, well, it's in your lease, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, well, I can't read my lease because I'm blind, and I finally just broke down the next time I renewed it and just had somebody sit down and read it to me. So make sure you have at least read to you. Make sure you know before you move in how the utilities are going to work. Is are you going to be responsible for the utilities, or is the complex going to pay for them, or is it going to be included in your rent? Make sure you have that information. And be sure you can give people directions to your apartment too. It took me a long time to learn how to do that, but it's important when you move in there to be able to give somebody driving directions to your apartment if you have to. And not necessarily straight from where they happen to be to your location, but have a certain landmark that you can say, okay, when you get to this point, this is what you do, steps 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. That way, you know, you'll be able to give the information if somebody does need to get there for whatever reason, they're able to do that. And it also helps if you have paratransit or you're using paratransit, and a lot of drivers, especially if it's a difficult place to find and the drivers have trouble finding it, you'll save time if you can tell them exactly how to get there.
Yeah, this is Larry. that's a lot of good suggestions there. And I would recommend for those that are actually looking to buy a place, make sure you have a reputable inspector along with your realtor and all that stuff to make sure to go over everything with you about the place you're interested in, to make sure you know of any hidden problems there may be. Also, the networking thing, and along with that, make sure you have people you know that know how to get to you also in case any disaster may strike, you know, whether it's severe weather, fire, anything like that. They know, you know, how to get to you real fast, and they know how to get a hold of you.
Yes, indeed. And getting back to appliances, some you're going to have a terrible time. Some are just, especially the newer ones. You're right; it's going to be almost impossible to do anything with. But you'd be amazed how, if the equipment is at all modifiable, a piece of dymo tape or a locator dot or even high marks or spot and line pen. You might need some help doing it, but you'd be amazed at some of the things that appear to be just absolutely lost causes. Even some of the new cooktops that they have with the cool burners or the cool tops. I've heard now where people have been able to mark those with a little ring just around the edge of the top of the burner itself, and they've been able to use those. You know, don't give up. What Larry said earlier, or someone said earlier, I forget whom, about self-confidence. When I left my family home, I said, I must do this on my own. And, in fact, when I left Florida, I sat in my motel, and I said, I could just pack up this, I could just pick up this luggage and just call a taxi and just fly right back. Maybe in 1978 I could still do that. I don't know. But I think if I did that and I tried to leave again, I would have already proven that I couldn't. And my family situation being what it was, I suppose, again, you've got the gist of the idea that my mother was very domineering, and she would love to throw that up to me. And I said, no, Pammy, you can't do this. You've got to make this work, and you've got to make it work now. And I had to know, and I think Dad knew it too, that when I moved out, it had to be for keeps. So self-confidence, it's one of the best things you've got going for you.
This is Larry again. One other thing about the appliances, I know Whirlpool is one of the best ones that will supply you with a Braille template free of charge. So if you have a Whirlpool appliance, you can definitely do that. I think GE and Maytag are a few others that do that as well. Another thing that's very helpful, a lot of the air and heating units now have, you know, these programmable thermostats. There is a talking programmable thermostat that you can go to talkingthermostats.com and get one of those. They even have them for the heat pumps, and they're very good. So there's a lot of technology out there that can help us upgrade our own appliances, you know, whether it's the washer, dryer, the stove, you know, even these new fridges that have these control panels on the front for your ice and water and all that sort of stuff.
The stove we have, this is Doug Lawler in Newfoundland. The stove we have, actually, it isn't this. We've got a glass stovetop which I can use without any problem. What I did with it the first time we got it, I made sure the stove was turned off, and I felt where the burners were, and the burners do have a different texture, say, than the rest of the stove. So basically, I got to know where the burners were and know where to basically lay the pots and pans and stuff on the stove. That's not the problem. The problem is the oven we have. It's the first one I've seen like it. It has very flat, barely discernible push buttons, and that's not the worst of it. If you want to set the temperature on it, you really can't, because you're just pressing these up and down arrows, and they make no beeps or tones or anything of any kind to tell you that you've even pressed the button. So it's a very difficult oven to use. That's why I brought up the question. I just thought it was sort of interesting, and I was just wondering if other people have ran into this type of situation before.
Yeah, Doug, this is Larry. I know the Whirlpool units, because Rachel just bought one last year, or maybe 2 years ago now, I can't remember, but the Whirlpool ones do beep when you push the buttons, and you just remember that when you go to set the oven, it defaults to 350 degrees, and then you just kind of use your up and down arrows, and it goes up and down in five-digit increments. So if you push it once up, it'd go from 350 to 355 and so on. But yeah, it does beep, and had very good luck with it as far as accessibility goes.
Yeah, that those arrow keys would be a handy way to go with these Whirlpools. Sound like that's a good thing. When we got a Sharp microwave, we got a template for that, so I can tell, because the microwaves are hard to feel if you don't have something like that on there, because you can't, I mean, it's sort of like a membrane. You can't hardly feel the thing. But so a friend of mine in Arizona said that he's got a General Electric microwave where you set the time or thing like that by, I mean, they still use a dial on that. It's amazing. You turn the dial so many clicks for a minute, and then so many more for two or whatever. That'd be for 2 minutes or things of that nature are set by, I suppose, time or, I don't know, probably temperature. They even have one for popcorn nowadays. I've had this for quite a while. Probably have to get a new one sometime. Had this for 15 years. But, Pam, this is Gary. I was the one that mentioned about self-confidence. I guess if people realize, if a person makes a choice to live on their own, if they have the self-confidence, then people will be convinced that you can make a go of it. But there is all sorts of frustrations along the way.
Oh, you're so right, Gary. You're so right. I'm glad you clarified that, because that deserves to be acknowledged. Doug, is it possible at all? Because I'm a great experimenter. I'm one of those that never knows when to quit. But is there any way that someone could work with you and maybe kind of show you how many taps of the arrow up or down it would take to raise or lower the temperature? Or some of those scroll arrows or buttons are the worst. The first VCR that I ever got was very easy. And of course, those are becoming more common now, are the ones that rely on the scrolling option, where you hold the button down, or the sighted person holds the button down, and it just travels. And the first VCR like that I ever had, I could not work. My very first VCR, all I had to do was just tap, 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 tap through the channels, through the time, through the date, through the channels, and I could program anything I wanted. No modification necessary. Now it is not that easy. But I wonder if there's any way a certain press of holding the button down for a second might give you a 2-degree reading or something of that nature. Would that help at all? Especially if you were able to put some sort of identifying mark on the arrows.
There's this stove, or this oven, what we have here is a countertop stove and a separate wall oven. The actual wall oven does seem to have these scroll-type arrow keys. So if you tap it just a shade too long, you might get 5 degrees, or you might get like 7 or 8 degrees. It's a very difficult thing for someone who cannot see it to use.
That's right. So excuse me, can't talk. I'm losing my headphones. There we go. I think the key here is that you just need to really be creative. And what I always used to tell my students when I taught some of the independent living skills is that if it's safe and it's effective and it works for you, then go with it. It can be something as simple as putting, you know, scotch tape can do wonders. I used to have a microwave and I put scotch tape all over it to indicate some of the buttons. So even if you have something that may not have Braille overlays or whatever, there's a lot to be said for a patient, creative, sighted person, and your own creativity, and just kind of household, you know, tape or some way to mark things. The other thing that I always found was handy is that anytime I had a sighted person over, and if there was something I maybe needed to have read, have some kind of a way to take a note or a voice recorder or something available, so that you could kind of maximize the time that you had with that person. You know, maybe you had 30 seconds. Okay, can you tell me what this is real quick? And, you know, be able to put any kind of notes that you needed in an accessible format, so that when you didn't have that person there, then you could still have access to those notes.
As long as the button, say, does not continue to scroll. That was the problem with my clock. I could set the clock on this one VCR, but it would continue to move while I was setting it, and by the time I had gotten to the minute I wanted, it was at the next minute, and I could not stall it, could not freeze it during the setting process. But with the oven, you might, and I'm not suggesting that you know, stress yourself doing it, or even that you're not trying hard enough. What I'm suggesting is that with time and practice, and maybe you will have a couple of slightly toasted, overdone something or others, but after a while you might just become able to say, okay, it's been down long enough. Okay, let it go, tap, tap, that's enough. And it may become easier. I mean, as long as you're stuck with this thing, I don't know if you could, or the next, maybe you can investigate another stove, another oven, I should say. Maybe that would be the best situation after all. But beyond that, maybe you can just fuss with this thing and until you've got it down. Because it is hard.
You know, this is Matt, by the way, from Florida, talking about expanding on a point Rachel made about when you have sighted people over, maximize their time. Something I do with my one sighted friend that helps me out a lot is I will combine that with other things. Like, I needed help writing a check one time, so since he was coming over after work, we just went out to dinner and got the check done at the same time. You know, you can always combine stuff. If you have stuff that needs to be read and you know you're going to be around a sighted person and you trust that person, you can get it done then. Talking about experimentation, I've done that as well. I have one of those microwaves that when you turn the dial, and I don't have my stove marked at the apartment. I have a conventional stove, but I pretty much know where the high, medium, and low is because the high clicks, and I can just estimate medium and low from that. And I don't use the oven because I don't need to, but I could if I had to. But experimentation is a good idea, but I think get sighted help wherever you can, because in my experience living on my own, sighted help is hard to find. It's hard to find people you can trust when you need to get stuff done, and the few people you do find that can help you with stuff, don't overuse it. Try to limit how much you ask them to do, because after a while they're going to get tired of it. This is Matt from Florida, by the way.
Yeah, that's interesting comments. I think everybody's made some interesting comments tonight. Matt, you mentioned something about how do you do that? This networking, but I think that's pretty much what networking is all about. Staying in touch with friends and family that'll be willing to help you, and maybe other blind people that you know, and they can give you some advice and things of that nature, and that's where I think we can do a job here on ACB Radio, I think, by helping the people that are coming along now. That's what this show is about, giving people a chance to find out what the life is like, and help them face the future, how to deal with what's ahead.
Well, Gary, you've segued nicely into our conclusion. I think our program has, in fact, given people a pretty good opportunity to explore some of the do's and don'ts of living on your own. I think we have been able to explore many of the issues that come up, and I think that probably what's emerged is that though it may be difficult, and though it may require you to do a fair amount of work, there is an immense satisfaction to be gained and an immense sense of independence to be gained from living on your own. And I would suspect that most of the people who are on this program tonight who live on their own would tell you that they'd never go back to a situation where they had to live with someone else again. And I think that that's really the point. Point is that living on your own and being able to develop the skills to do that is an ultimate sign of how well you've adjusted to your visual impairment. And perhaps we in ACB and we at local chapter levels might think about doing more forums on subjects like how do you negotiate a lease? What should you try to put in it? What are the issues of finding accessible apartments? What do you do when there is discrimination? Because I think there's still a lot that many of the folks who are having to deal with living on their own for the first time don't know and don't have easy places to find answers to. Nevertheless, I'd like to thank everyone who participated tonight, as well as Rachel and Larry, for their assistance. I'd also like to thank Dave for the work that he will have to do editing this program, and George Bies for making Talking Communities available to us. Living on your own isn't easy, but it's very satisfying. If you don't do it now, think about doing it in the future. In the meantime, thanks for listening to us on Tuesday Topics this evening, and we look forward to seeing you next week on Tuesday Topics on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community. Next week on Tuesday Topics, we're going to explore the whole idea of attending a convention. What can you expect when you attend a convention of, say, the American Council of the Blind? How do you get around? How do you deal with people you like, and how do you deal with people you don't like? If you're being pursued by somebody and you don't like it, what can you do about it? How do you get around? How do you know what's going on? What kinds of options do you have in terms of maximizing your enjoyment of a convention where there's an immense number of things going on and a bunch of people with dogs and canes everywhere? If you're thinking of coming to the ACB convention, or would just like to hear about other people's experiences, good, bad, and ugly, join us on Tuesday Topics next week when we will be discussing conventional wisdom about conventions. So join us for Tuesday Topics on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.